across Northern Ireland, on your radio, and on BBC Sounds. This is The Stephen Nolan Show!
Hello everyone, from potholes to the very latest situation on Ukraine, and then the podcast that Vinny and I made back in 2019 about the disappearance of Marion Beattie. We speak to her younger brother this morning as the coroner is due to report on Marion Beattie in a couple of weeks' time. So there's lots and lots in this programme. If you're looking for a bit of variety, it's right here on The Nolan Show. Thanks for listening. The Stephen Nolan Show! Good morning, everybody. Another week of Nolan shows. Don't forget Nolan Live, BBC One, 10:40 this Wednesday night. Here we are on the radio. If you want to send me a tweet, you can't send an X, can you? Sounds a bit dodgy. If you want to send me a tweet, it's at Stephen Nolan. Loads of different ways for you to stay in touch with me throughout the day. Our top story, these masked men. Let's get our heads around this. Man, critical condition. Critical but stable condition in hospital after being shot by masked men in West Belfast. It happened at around 10:30 yesterday morning when the men fired several shots at the victim as he sat in his taxi in Belsteel Manor in Dunmurry. The Sinn Féin MLA, Danny Baker, said the community is deeply concerned and there's no justification for guns on our streets.
Very worrying, reckless behaviour for this to be happening in our community. Those behind it need to get off the back of our communities. It's a very busy area, it's heavily populated, and there's also children in a nearby football pitch going to training. Extremely dangerous and something that we don't want to see in our communities ever again.
Belfast Telegraph crime correspondent Alison Morris with us this morning. So what's happened here, Alison? Good morning.
Yeah, well, I mean, as you just heard there from Danny Baker, I was on the scene as well yesterday, and it is a really heavily populated area. There was people trying to go about their business who were being redirected by the PSNI as they did. So the victim of this attack was sitting in his taxi, as you heard. He was sitting at the depot where he works when two gunmen approached. One was obviously just there to keep a watch out, and the other one fired five shots. One of those shots hit him in the shoulder, I'm told. So he suffered an injury, a very serious and painful injury, but not a life-threatening one. The emergency services were very quickly on the scene and he was rushed to hospital. And when I was there yesterday, there was a cordon around the crime scene. His car was still there with the door open. You could see that there was glass broken through the window where they'd fired through the window at him. But thankfully, he didn't suffer any kind of serious injury.
Who's behind this, Alison?
So the group that we would call Oglan Aharon, ONH, are meant to be on ceasefire but have been responsible for a number of murders of people who would have been connected to all kinds of criminality and all sorts of things over the past few years. But they had a split probably around September last year. And up until then, now it's been a sort of war of words. There's been graffiti painted on walls. There's been a lot of propaganda throughout the various journalists. There's been things put on social media, but we haven't seen it escalate into this kind of violence. So this has been obviously marked a very serious escalation in that, and one which I'm assuming that the PSNI will be aware that there's the really potential for there to be some sort of retaliation in regards to this.
And is this a feud between two gangs or what?
Yeah, I mean, there's a few between, apparently one gang, really. I mean, it's a group of people who would have been quite united up until about maybe the summer of last year. And then there was a fallout where a handful of members left and went elsewhere. Now, what I've been told yesterday is that those members are attempting, as we speak, to join the new IRA and to be taken into another organisation. Now, that's going to pose real difficulties, and I can see how the PSNI would be really concerned, because the new IRA obviously would have access to arms, access to weapons. You could see how this could escalate really quickly into something very bloody, and where a lot of innocent people could maybe potentially be caught up in it. But it's a feud basically between a group called ONH, and they are someone who have been in existence probably, if you go back till, you know, way back to 2008, they were responsible for the bomb attack on Paddyheffron, for the bomb outside MI5 headquarters, all of those sort of things. They've probably been one of the most active distant Republican groups up until now, and then they went on ceasefire for a while and haven't attacked any security force targets but are fighting with each other.
And they've been linked to a number of gun murders in Belfast in recent years.
Yeah, well, off the top of my head, I can think of Warren Crossing. There was a murder of Mark Hall, the murder of Jim Donegan, the murder of Sean Fox. We also have people like Kieran Wiley, who were members of that organisation, but had fallouts with them, who were killed as well. So yeah, probably I would say about 8 people, maybe in the last maybe 6 or 7 years, who have been murdered by that organisation.
And how sophisticated are they as a group? How big are they as a group? How knowledgeable are they in instilling terror as a group?
Not very big at all. I mean, you talked about maybe less than 100 people here, but people who obviously have access to weapons, access to new weapons as well. So a lot of those murders that I've just mentioned were carried out using new weapons with no ballistics history. So the PSNI weren't able to trace those weapons back to, say, being involved in Troubles era shootings. They have access to quite new weapons, quite sophisticated weapons, but they weren't considered to be that big a threat, I suppose, to either security, like national security, as it was called, or even domestic criminality, up until maybe a few years ago when they started being involved in the murder of people who had been linked to the drugs trade. And that was something that we were watching very closely, something that I've reported on numerous times. This is different. This is an infighting situation. This is very personality-led, and it has the potential to get quite vicious.
Alison, when you say the potential to get quite vicious, tell me what you mean and whether we should be worried about this. Obviously, we're worried about any violence on the streets, but is this going to be contained to them fighting between themselves?
No, well, I mean, these are people who, obviously, there is a very serious issue now that this one person has been attacked, he has survived, and you would expect there would be retaliation for that. Now, while many people listen to this will probably think, well, that's just, you know, people fighting among themselves, you know, it's not going to cause me any issues. Well, that attack happened at, you know, 10 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday morning, while people were trying to go about outside shops where people were trying to go about their business. I mean, when I was there was people coming along with their children on bikes in prams, you know, trying to go up and down that road where the shooting had took place. Had they been there when that happened, given this seemed to be on the face of a very unexperienced gunman, someone who maybe hadn't shot anyone before, there was bullets flying, you know, in all directions, and someone could have been seriously hurt who was just walking past as well. So you cannot confine these things to the people involved in them. There is the potential that they could reach outside and attack other people as well.
So maybe you can stay there for just a moment or two. The Alliance MLA Policing Board member, Peter McReynolds, listening to this morning. Your reaction, Peter. Good morning.
Good morning, Stephen. Yeah, I mean, Alison's laid out there what took place yesterday, and it was shocking. Whenever I saw the scenes and I've heard what's taken place yesterday morning. I mean, we've heard on Good Morning also this morning, one of the MLAs for the area, Danny Baker, saying about how children were travelling at that point to a local football academy. And it's the kind of stuff you really see on the television screens taking place in modern Northern Ireland 2025. And to those people who have been involved in this, I would say, stop, it's not wanted, and you need to leave the stage.
Well, they're hardly going to do that, so what more can we do? They're not going to leave the stage.
Well, what we can do is work with the police, support the police, keep the police informed as to what for their investigation that's currently taking place, and make sure that these people are brought to justice.
Do you hold out any hope that we could infiltrate these groups any more than the police already have?
I think over the last number of years, the police have done really good work through the paramilitary task force that was set up. The police are working day in, day out. I was out with them a number of months ago, taking part in a ride-along, and I saw the challenges that they were facing and the varying things that they do. If we support the police, these people will be brought to justice. I'm confident of that.
Kelly Bonner is in Poolglass this morning. What's the mood on the street, Kelly? Good morning.
Morning, Stephen. It's pretty calm here at the minute. We are standing right at the cordon, and in fact, just as I'm standing here, there's a mother talking to a police officer. She's trying to figure out whether or not she can walk down the road with her children. In fact, I'm sure you can hear it now. There's another parent trying to figure out if they can get to school with their children. We've been speaking to a couple of people. We've been here about a half an hour. And I think the mood is just one of shock. You know, this is a really heavily populated area. It's quite a popular area with young children. And I think people are absolutely fuming that this has happened. In fact, on a Sunday, there's about 100 children here playing football at a football academy. At a soccer camp, and all of those children were there yesterday when the shooting happened.
They were out in the streets. The kids were out in the streets when this happened.
They're out in Sally Gardens, which is a football club, like an academy, a football academy. So it's an organised event from about 10:30 to 12:00 every Sunday. And it's about 30 yards from where the shooting happened.
Kelly, thank you for that. Peter McReynolds, thank you. Alison Morris, before you go, this morning, I know your newspaper, the Belfast Telegraph, has been writing about this. You look at the breadth of what happens in Northern Ireland. I just want to get your view on the story that I know you've been talking about, writing about in your newspaper, of the vetting that the PSNI is employing, and whether people who have a criminal past, a paramilitary past, should be allowed into the police.
I think it's a fascinating subject, to be quite honest with you, and one that that is sure, when we come to Northern Ireland, is very unique to ourselves, because it would be a completely black and white issue. Was it anywhere else? You would say, well, no, of course, anyone who has any kind of support for a paramilitary past should not be allowed in the PSNI. But we live through a conflict. So to say that question that we know is asked on that vetting form, and we've now seen the vetting form, it's been posted online, to say that nobody who has supported any kind of paramilitary group would mean that, you know, the children of the First Minister, had they liked or commented or participated in any kind of commemoration for someone who maybe died 30, 40, 50 years ago, could potentially be excluded from joining the PSNI. I mean, I suppose in my column today, I pointed out, you know, the children or grandchildren of David Irvine, the PUP leader who helped bring about our peace process, would be excluded from being a member of the PSNI should they attend a commemoration in relation to their father or grandfather. I mean, that is a very strange situation, which doesn't exist anywhere else in the UK, but does exist here, and it's something that maybe the policing board need to clarify.
I'm pretty surprised that that story and the conversation around it wasn't bigger, given the implications for Northern Ireland PLC, and we still don't know what weight the police are giving when someone fills in that form and says, yeah, look, I, you know, let's say they declared that in the past they have supported paramilitaries, or they have said, like our First Minister Michelle O'Neill has said, there was no alternative to violence. So we just simply don't know if you should apply to the PSNI if you've done that in the past. The cops aren't telling us.
Well, I mean, they're saying that they want people from working class communities to apply to join the PSNI. But yet if you had maybe, say, a grandfather who was killed and was a member of the IRA 50 years ago, and you had attended a memorial in relation to that person, does that exclude you from joining the police? I mean, we, as you said, we don't know, because there's no clarity given around that. But looking at the vetting form that new recruits have to sign, well, yes, it should exclude all people who have someone who was involved in any kind of, whether they were in the UDA, the NLA, the UVF or the UDA. And that is a very strange situation, when the Chief Constable is saying, we want people from working class, loyalist and Republican communities to apply to join the PSNI. We want a really diverse police force, which covers our entire population, which is, you know, reflective of the community it serves. And yet sections of that community, if you look at the vetting form, are potentially excluded.
Surely the policing board will raise this with the Chief Constable. Surely they will.
You would imagine they would raise it, and that they would ask for some clarity around it. And I'm assuming the Chief Constable would like some clarity around it, because he's working within the guidelines that exist presently. But at this point in time, I mean, we know that this was just raised by, you know, it was mentioned by John Burroughs on a during talkback. He said that, you know, potentially this would exclude you from members from being a member of the PSNI. I mean, I raised my eyebrows at the time and thought, well, you know, that's exaggerating a bit. Surely that would not exclude you from membership of the PSNI. But yes, the vetting form that we've since seen shows that it would exclude you.
And do you think the, for example, Sinn Féin, and obviously the DUP have questions around this as to where they stand on this, but would Sinn Féin tolerate it? Their contract is to, with Northern Irish people since the Good Friday Agreement, is to support the police, and that's what they do. But are Sinn Féin just ambivalent to whether people who supported their view in the past as to the need for violence are banned from the police?
We know that Sinn Féin didn't, give support to the PSNI till 2007. The PSNI came into existence in 2001, so it took quite some time before they agreed to join the policing structure, to join the policing board, and all of that. It's been a very slow process, and, I come from a very nationalist community. I come from West Belfast, and I know the challenges that face the PSNI in terms of recruitment from that community. And this seems to be another barrier to that, because you're potentially saying that if someone attended an Easter commemoration, say, in West Belfast and posted a picture of that online, that would exclude them from membership of the PSNI. And that seems quite a strange situation when you think about what the PSNI are saying publicly in terms of what they're trying to recruit into the ranks to make it a more diverse police force.
And I'm just stressing, it doesn't necessarily mean they're banned. The police just aren't telling us.
Yeah.
And that in itself, how is that sustainable? That they're not telling people what relevance they will put on whether someone has supported violence in the past?
Well, they're not telling us, but it does exist on their vetting form. So technically, if they're following that to the letter of the law, well, then yes, it would exclude you. I mean, we can only go by what we've seen in terms of the application form to join the PSNI. And it should really exclude anyone who has attended any of those commemorations, or not even attended them, liked a post about one of them. I mean, that's how in-depth that form goes. Does that really apply? Will that really exclude someone from membership of the police? And in any other place, we would look at this and go, well, yeah, of course it would exclude you from membership of the police. But we're a post-conflict society, and are we treated differently? Or are we just treated exactly the same as elsewhere? At which point, you're probably excluding maybe 50-60% of working class young people from loyalist and Republican communities.
Alison, thanks very much. 03030 80 55 55 is the number to call this morning. Now, our pothole problem is so bad we're going to need moon buggies to get around. This is the warning from one of our MLAs, the DUP MLA. Keith Buchanan's comments were reported in the Sunday Life yesterday. He was speaking at the Infrastructure Committee earlier this month and said many surfaces in his Mid Ulster constituency are in a bad state.
Some people are buying new trainers, but the rest of us are going to buy moon buggies.
Yeah.
Because the roads are that bad.
Speaking to the roads expert and commentator Wesley Johnson, I asked him how bad the pothole problem is.
The potholes problem in Northern Ireland has been getting worse for years and years now. We've been underinvesting for 15, 20 years now. Every time there's a storm like Eowyn, you get water washing across the roads and you get more potholes forming. And the basic problem we have is that we don't have the cash to maintain the road to the standards. Over time, the condition is getting worse.
So I don't understand how the same potholes keep on breaking down. 2025, we can fly to the moon, but we can't fix a pothole permanently.
One of the difficulties is that to really prevent potholes from happening, you need to resurface the entire road periodically. And because we don't have the money for that, the solution we have instead is a sort of a pragmatic one of kind of filling the holes as and when they appear. The difficulty with that then is that you haven't resurfaced the whole road, so that particular pothole sort of has a square cut out tarmac put in, which does make it a little bit more susceptible to happening again.
And there's nothing we can do about that?
The only real long-term solution to this is to properly invest in structural maintenance. And you'll know better than me just how difficult the public finances are at the minute. So, until such times as the executive can fund the hundreds of millions that would be needed to bring it back up to the standard, then continuing to fill potholes as and when they appear is basically the only show in town.
Is that subbed out? Is the pothole fixing subbed out? Somebody must be making a lot of money going round and round in circles fixing these things.
Yeah, it's cheaper to fix, you know, 10 potholes across several kilometres of road than it is to resurface the whole road. DFI have contractors who do that for them. There is the problem, of course, too, that people make claims whenever there's holes in the road. And I think DFI sort of take the view that, you know, even paying compensation claims is probably cheaper than, you know, trying to find the cash from the minister to solve the problem at source.
And Wesley, how bad are our roads compared to the South, the Republic of Ireland, and compared to elsewhere than in the UK?
Yeah, I think the roads in the South are generally speaking better than they are here. The pothole problem is similar in the rest of the UK. I mean, if you go and look at local media in the UK, you see a lot of stuff about potholes, you know, so they have a similar problem that we do. But you do tend to notice it most in the rural areas because that's the roads with the lowest traffic. And DFI tend to prioritise the roads that have the highest traffic. So unfortunately, that means that the rural roads are the ones that are going to stay with the potholes for the longest. And that's where you'll see them.
So the storms have made the situation even worse.
Yes, because what happens is, you know, during the frosty weather, you get ice forming in cracks in the road. The tarmac is loose. Then what happens is you get a storm like Eowyn, large quantities of water wash across the road. And that can be enough to wash out the material that's been loosened. So after a storm, you'll get new potholes will appear. I mean, it's not that the storm caused them, but they were the ones that sort of finally broke the camel's back, if you like, and washed the material out of the crack that was already there.
All right, Wesley, thank you very much indeed. Thanks for talking to us today.
Thank you, Stephen.
It's Wesley Johnston, the roads expert. You, of course, can tell us what it's like where you live and where you've seen these things. 030 30 80 55 55. Let's head to Cullyhanna. Thomas. Morning, Thomas.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. How's Cullyhanna today?
Yes, it's a shocking round here, this area. I can mind back a long time. I never mind roads ever as bad.
Really?
Yes.
Are there many?
And when you come out of one, you hit another one. You can't just miss them, they're that bad. You know, there was a girl that lives beside me the other evening. She went into a big pothole and damaged her good car late, and she didn't afford to spend money on that. You know, well, I think it's getting, this country's getting a third world country. There'll be better roads in Africa.
And of course, people are entitled to claim compensation. I just wonder, is the department banking on people don't? They don't get around it?
There'll be a lot of red tape attached to it. But if you would think, like, the money they're paying out would fill a lot of potholes. That's why, like, I'm mystified at that.
43 million, according to the figures the Belfast Telegraph got a hold of.
Yes, that would fill a lot of potholes around the whole country.
43 million in the last 5 years.
Yes, that's astonishing.
And in 2019-20, these are all Belfast Telegraph figures that they've got from the Department for Infrastructure. DFI and DVA paid out 3 million in claims 2019. Look what happened by 2023. That figure more than doubled to over £7.5 million, Thomas.
Yes, it's totally mind-boggling. That would do a lot of work on roads, like. You know, there's something wrong with these people that's in charge. You know?
Absolutely. And look, it's no laughing matter, this. This is dangerous. These things are dangerous. People swerving around them. Martin and Bangor, for example. You're from the Motorcycle Action Group. Yes, Martin.
That's
slipped
correct.
My mind. You just needed to give me one more second. The Motorcycle right. Action Group. And these are dangerous, aren't they?
They are very dangerous. There are actually no roads that I and other motorcyclists avoid because of the condition and the potholes.
That's crazy.
And it's becoming, in my opinion, it's becoming actually life-threatening in certain areas. I can think of a couple of roads nearby where I live that if I didn't know potholes were in certain parts of bends, if you hit them coming around, motorcycle, soapy bubble, you know.
And where are they?
Down around by Six Road Ends, down the Arts Peninsula, various places.
That's crazy. So you're actually avoiding whole roads now because of these?
Yeah, sections of roads or entire roads. Well, I mean, I am, and I know certain other motorcyclists are, not necessarily every motorcyclist, but there are some roads now that are just It's very, very tricky, very dicey to ride on.
And I was thinking of a car, obviously. I was thinking of the damage it does to a car. But if you're on a motorbike, my goodness, you're even more exposed.
Well, the thing is, you see, the DFI's criteria, I believe, for fixing potholes means that they'll fix all the biggest and worst ones, which is great. But there are very many of the smaller potholes that are situated in certain parts of the road that don't cause a car any problem, but can cause a motorcyclist great problem.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the smaller defects can be lethal to a motorcycle, but just be a bit of a bump in the road for you or me in our cars.
We need this country sorted. There's so much to get on with doing, isn't there? And we need money to fix these things.
Yeah.
And we cover every week in the Nolan Show all the different demands that there is on that finite pot of money.
TV program.
I knew you were.
On that video, I put it to the DFI. We understand and accept that money is a problem. But what we're asking for them is to be more imaginative and use the money more wisely.
What's that mean? How can you be imaginative fixing a pothole?
Well, you know, fixing more of the more minor defects. I mean, motorcyclists are the most vulnerable road user group, and the DFI have a duty of care to pay attention to our safety needs, just as they have for cyclists, pedestrians, equestrians, and, of course, car drivers. But we don't believe that they are paying sufficient attention to our safety needs, because they're not taking care of a lot of these. They're taking care of all the defects that will give trouble to the most vehicles, i.e. cars, but they're not paying proper attention to our safety needs by repairing more of the minor defects.
Martin, thank you. We'll pause there. Lots of you calling this morning about this. We'll come back after the news. Really interesting interview coming up with Professor Paul Moorcraft. Paul's a former Ministry of Defence analyst. He's a strategist. He's the author of Putin's Wars, NATO's Flaws. We'll look at the situation in Ukraine with him very shortly. First, back to the potholes. We'll head to Port of Ogie, will we? David. Morning, David.
Good morning, Stephen. Like your last caller there, I am not a motorcyclist, but I'm a triker. So I have three wheels. And
triker? Why are you a triker? Who wants to be a triker?
Oh, loads of us. Island trikers. Ask any of them there. There's thousands of us.
Really? A tricycle?
All over the world. Yes, a three-wheeled motorcycle. I've been for years, but I have to have one now anyway because... But although saying that, the one I'm riding now, I built it in 1974.
Right.
Okay. Still running today, beautiful. But I've had the commercial ones. I have to have them now because I also drove motorbikes then, because I have two artificial hips, and it's very hard to ride a motorcycle with artificial hips because you come to the stop.
I want to ask you, but remind me before you go this morning to ask you about that.
Yes, you put your feet down and you get the... You get a jerk and then you have to stop. So three wheels is the answer anyway. But I love three wheels. But three wheels coming along with the potholes. Yes, in the middle of the road, you can't miss them where the car does. And if they're in the inside, you're still going to hit them. But what I was going to say was, which I said to your reporter, your person who took a phone, we've moved down from Newtownards down here to Port of Ogie the last 6 years, where we used to live years ago. And honestly, there are holes down here that have been here, marked in red, mind you, especially between Ballyhalbert and Kirkcaldy. There are holes along a part of that road, which is very the road you would take from here to go into Kirkcaldy to go up to the Nars. They're marked in red, and they've been there. And we're here 6 years past September. Them holes are still there.
Oh, come on. They haven't been unfixed for 6 years.
Stephen, please bring your car out and take a run. Do this. Take a run down Portaferry via Kirkcaldy.
Yeah, it's a lovely part of the world.
Yes, and then come back again by Bangor up into Newtownards again via Ballywalder, Ballyhalbert. You will not believe. Now, the last MOT we went for there...
It's all very picturesque down there, isn't it? And if people were coming to Northern Ireland, you would hope that they would go down and visit down there. And you're telling me they're going to be wrecking their cars with the potholes.
visitors coming to drive down. I used to be a coach driver, and I took people down here in buses and stuff around the peninsula. It's beautiful there. You know, everywhere's beautiful on a beautiful day, of course, but it is beautiful down here. And people, any visitors coming, hiring a car out and coming down here, they won't believe it. Now, we were up to Craig Avon the other day, had the cause to go up there and out to Achillea. Different roads altogether. That's the first thing, even out at Achillea, a wee back place. Stephen, take a run out, please, and see. I remember there was a report now.
Will you pay the petrol if I run out there?
I would, yes.
I'm only joking.
I would pay you the pay. I would.
I'm only joking.
I come and pay. Let me just finish with this, Stephen. We were at a funeral one day, and rather than taking two cars back to the graveyard, which was about 3 miles away, we got into our friend's first cousin of my wife, who drives a top-of-the-range Merc. And I said, oh, this will be all right to the wife. Come on, not feel these bumps now. We felt the bumps not just the same as we do in our
week. Of course you did. You know, tell me this before you go.
Yes.
Because my ears pricked up when you said you had two artificial hips.
Yes.
So, right, I remember Eamon Holmes saying, once you get to 50, everything starts to stops working, right?
Yes.
I remember him telling me, it was actually when it was coming up to his 50th birthday. So I hit 50 there a year ago, whenever it was. I have this pain on my left-hand side, just at the corner on my hip. And it radiates right down my leg. I feel it when I'm in bed. I feel it when I'm waking up in the morning. I feel it. I'm walking with a limp now. I'm walking like John Wayne.
Yes.
Is that my hip?
Exactly. That sounds to me, I was 18 months in crutches before I got my hips done.
Oh.
And they're in 14 years now, and the right one is done. I need another one. If I haven't got £16,000 to replace it, I have to wait 4 to 5 years.
So is that going to deteriorate? Is that how it starts, where you get that pain radiating down your leg?
It is, Stephen, right?
No.
And you need an x-ray to see if there's any cushioning left between the bones and your hip and the joint. That's the way I got it.
And have I done that because of the weight?
Not at all. No, you know, I got these in 14 years ago, and at that time I was, 11 and a half stone. And
all right.
I'm 5 foot 11. And now I'm 13, 10 because I can't walk with the hips. I can't walk long distances, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And
I'm
now
sure
this
is starting
to hurt me. Sorry, Stephen, the only last up to 13, 14 years anyway, you know.
A hip?
Yes, that's along the last.
You pay $14,000 and it only last?
Yes.
What?
Some people, Stephen, if you read about it even there, but they've told me anyway, Mr. Burnley says you'll be getting it. Once you get these hips in, you'll need them replaced in about 13, 14 years. And now one of them is done. So,
I'm sure people can pick up the phone this morning and tell me their experiences of getting a hip replacement. I cannot believe I'm talking about this. Now, it could be a wee trapped nerve, and there I have myself with a hip replacement. I don't know, but it's just constantly sore.
If it's a hip, Stephen, you'll know what I'm telling you, because
I know.
Well, please take the wee drive down the peninsula, honestly, down just around that way by Kirkcaldy, back up by Clochy, Ballywalter, right through Donaghadee now, and up to Bangor, you see the potholes. On the main road, I'm not talking to the back road, the main road. Unbelievable.
David, thank you. Morning, Eddie. Morning, Eddie.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning.
I have worked in the tarmac business for over 50 years. I'm retired now, and I've done quite a lot of patching.
Quite a lot of patching?
Yes, that's the holes and whatnot.
So you're one of those boys that patches it, and then a wee bit later it breaks down again?
But the ones I didn't, it didn't happen.
You're a winner.
I'll tell you what way to do them. And they're not doing this way. You cut the patch out and you take it down 100 millimeter deep, right? You put a base course on, a 1.5 inch stone, real rough tarmac. You put that on and you leave 40 mil for worn course.
Why is this man telling me how to patch a road? I will never patch a road in my life. I don't even put a nail in the wall.
Listen to me. If you do it this way, there'll be very little patches.
Yes. I'll not be doing it.
Seal around I know you're not be doing it, but seal around the edges with bitumen, put your worn course on, give it a good rolling, and it'll be there for a good while. I see them now doing it. They come with a pick, they pull the top coat off, and they throw a bit of tarmac in the way they go. That's not the way to do it.
And none of yours disintegrated, no? Your potholes are intact.
I'm retired this 10 years, and I could take you to a few of them are still there.
Tell you what, I wonder how many of them last these days.
Well, you find if they take it out right and do it properly and put the proper base coat on, they shouldn't have a problem.
So why are they doing it differently now?
You tell me. They're bound to be supervisors going around, and when you get the quote to do it, they tell you what to do and they don't do it.
I bet you were kept busy. You were never short of work.
I was never short of work.
Okay. Eddie, thank you very much indeed. Okay. Morning to you. Lots of you still calling us about this and indeed about hips. 030-30-80-55-55. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky says he's ready to resign in exchange for peace. He was speaking at a press conference today after Donald Trump, it was yesterday he was speaking, called him a dictator without elections. Earlier, I spoke to Professor Paul Moorcraft, a former Ministry of Defence analyst who's worked all over the world, including Ukraine. He's an expert on military strategy and author of Putin's Wars, NATO's Flaws. I asked him for his analysis 3 years on from Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine.
I think Russia is winning. I admire Ukrainians' bravery. But Russia is, as you said earlier on, is just much bigger and much stronger. And it's got China backing it. But in the last week, you mentioned personalities. It's the biggest change in world affairs since 1945. And there's as much danger in the world now as there was in 1945, or perhaps the Cuban Missile Crisis, 1962. Trump is an old man in a hurry. He's a disruptor. He's doing his best to live up to his campaign promises. I think he will achieve a settlement, but it will be one which will be very pro-Putin. To me, this reminds me of the period, because there are periods in history. For example, the Congress system after the fall of Napoleon from 1815 onwards, and there were 30 or 40 years maybe of stability. And so the system has changed. We had the Cold War and then the collapse of the Soviet Union. People said it was the end of history. It wasn't. We've got a new period now, a completely new period. And Trump has destroyed the Western alliance system. And it means that everybody in this country, in Britain, is going to have to pay an awful lot more for its defense, more tax, less on welfare and so on, because we have been freeloading on the Americans. Trump has a point. We need to do something because the armed forces, they're still good man for man, woman for woman, but they've been hollowed out, to use the conventional phrase. So we're all going to have to start defending ourselves, particularly in Europe, and not relying on the Americans, who are shifting more towards and have been shifting for 10 years, more towards China and the defense of their interests there.
Some might say, Paul, how did we get away with it for so long, paying so little?
Yes, we did assume that it would go on and on and on. And it's various governments, not just the Labour government or the Conservatives. I was an instructor at Sandhurst, and I was an instructor at the Staff College, which is colonel and above. I've watched a really good armed forces, and I've had the privilege of working with them in the Balkans, in a lot of different places in the middle of armed forces. They're good. But you can only do so much when you're so small. For example, they always talk about the SAS, and the Americans always praise the SAS. Now, it's only a small number who are active at one stage, maybe a few hundred. But you've got to have a big pool to get such good troops. And the pool is now much smaller, 74,000, the least troops in the army we've ever had. So we have to build up the army. We have a lot to do. And to go back to your point, we have taken advantage of American goodwill. I don't support Trump in any way, but he is right on this. The Germans haven't, they need to rebuild their armed forces despite their history. A lot of countries are not even up to 2%. We are 2.3 at the moment. But that's very small. It needs to be 5 or 6%. Trump has delivered an almighty kick up the backside of European complacency. And it's about time we actually did something to defend Europe and ourselves.
You said a few minutes ago, Paul, that Trump is likely, that the deal that he brokers is likely to lean towards Putin. Why do you say that? Why is that likely, rather than leaning towards Zelensky?
Well, he doesn't like Zelensky, clearly, not just because of the recent war of words in the last week, calling him a dictator, unelected, and many other things, which is not true. But he does hold a grudge. Trump is a man who holds grudges because Zelensky didn't help him in 2019 when he asked for help against Biden's son, Hunter, who was involved with, allegedly involved with various crooked deals in Ukraine. And Trump asked for some, frankly, Zelensky to provide some dirt on Biden, Joe Biden's son. So there's a grudge factor here. And to answer your question, there seems to be a bromance between Trump and Putin, because Trump seems to like military types, warriors, and he seems to like dictators. Maybe he wants to be one himself. So there is this feeling that he's already given all, shown all his cards. He's played everything into Putin's hands. You know, not everything has been given away already. Now, I know that's part of his bargaining procedure. He throws, excuse the language, he throws, I'll say, excrement everywhere in all directions, and just to confuse the people then that he's negotiating with. But he seems to, he said it publicly, he trusts Putin more than he does his own intelligence services. Now, that is bonkers. How is he going to negotiate if he doesn't? He's recently backtracked on the fact that Zelensky will be there. He was excluding the Ukrainian president. But for, after all is said and done, he has a point when he says, what are the French and Germans and British done? He has begun the negotiating process. Okay, putting Zelensky at a disadvantage. It's quite clear what the deal is going to be. It's going to be an awful lot of land for hopefully some peace, which may or may not be guaranteed properly, i.e. by British soldiers and America, not American soldiers. We don't have enough men to put in anywhere, frankly. We can't even control our own streets at times. So it's going to be tough. The British electorate is going to have to face reality. But as soon as the war ends, and you've got to say that for Trump, he did enforce the ceasefire in Gaza. So the world is slightly better in the last month, although he's destroyed the alliance system. And it's exactly what NATO, the destruction of NATO unity, is exactly what Putin has always wanted.
What's in it for Trump?
He's chasing legacy. He wants to win the Nobel Peace Prize. That's one of his many ambitions, to be seen as a great peacemaker. And there was less war during his period, though you could say that he undermined what happened in Afghanistan for Biden. But Trump wants his legacy to be great peacemaker, making America great again, economically, militarily, to be respected. And he certainly, I mean, under Joe Biden, the Israelis got away with so much. And Trump is a great supporter of Israel, but Israel was benefiting from Biden's lethargy and benefiting from Trump's activism. So he wants to settle the Middle East. He's been wanting to do that for a long time, to be the great peacemaker. Remember the religious right, massive support for Trump and the Make America Great Again movement. Those evangelical Christians, in particularly southern states, who believe that the Christ is going to come once, for example, once is the capital and accepted capital of Israel, and the American embassy was shifted there. So Trump is after not only improving America, which he believes in, but he wants to see himself putting right all the mistakes which he thinks Biden made, but he wants to end the war. He promised, that was all in his campaigns, end the war in Ukraine and bring a settlement to the Middle East. Whether he wins the Nobel Peace Prize, I have no idea.
Paul, how's Ukraine likely to react to Putin hanging on to all of the land that he has so far acquired?
Is that better than losing the war? Many Ukrainians would think, well, we've suffered so much, we've lost so many brave soldiers' lives, should we not fight on? Maybe half of them feel that, others are desperate for peace. And it's always been the same. We used to say in the Middle East, peace for land. And what is clear is that Crimea, which has always been Russian, always, will be permanently ceded to Russia. There may be a deal on some of the ports that some money will be paid to Ukrainians. And when you talk about the Donbass, the 20% of the territory which has been taken since 2014, a lot of the Ukrainians, inverted commas, have been forced out, killed, arrested, and a lot of their children have been dispersed throughout Russia. So if there was a genuine plebiscite, there may not be that much support for membership of Ukraine, but there are other elements will happen. There will be a rundown of sanctions in exchange for perhaps some of the children being returned to Ukraine, because that is, the Russians have admitted to that, and that is a war crime. That is one of the reasons for the indictment by the International Criminal Court. Remember that Russia wants, Putin cannot travel effectively. He can be arrested if he travels in most countries. So there's step by step, and some of the money which has been held in banks could be returned. It would depend on whether, first of all, a ceasefire is established over the 800 kilometres. Secondly, whether the monitoring forces, including British, German and other European troops, hopefully with a backstop by America, there has to be efficient and effective monitoring of the ceasefire. Remember that the similar situation in Korea, which has gone on since 1953, it's a much smaller border, about a fifth of the size. So there are many elements to this: recognition, removal of sanctions, so on. It could be a complicated deal. But in the first case, Russia and America and Ukraine have to sit down and say, let's have a ceasefire. From there, everything else could come.
And finally, Professor Moorcraft, no matter what dressing is put around this, will this ceasefire be a surrender by Ukraine? Is that when Trump talks about how Putin and his army are bigger and stronger, is he essentially asking Ukraine to surrender? Or is that the case? Will that be the case?
Putin is very clear. He doesn't believe that a separate sovereign country exists. Ukraine was just a sphere of influence. It was a part of Russia and was part of the Soviet Union. It wants to destroy Ukraine, its religion, its art, its culture. Because if you look in the conquered areas, the museums have been looted and destroyed. So much has been destroyed. So with this deal, it depends. I said there would have to be a loss of territory, whether it would be ceded until the future. In other words, this would be a temporary measure. And how long is temporary? Similar to the ceasefire in after the Korean War. So that has gone on since 1953. That's a long time. So is it surrender? It depends. What to use the Marxist phrase, correlation of forces, the present correlation of forces looks very much against the Ukrainians. But in the end, there has to be some kind of peace, because if this goes on much longer, the destruction of the youth, young people, the amount of 8 or 9 million Ukrainians who have left, destruction of infrastructure. And this is the war in Europe. Who expected a war in Europe along the lines of the Second World War? And it's happened. And the war could spread. That is the issue, unless there's a proper guarantee. And America is the only one with the power to do that, whether Trump has the will. And I'm assuming that you've got the same leaders, that Trump is not assassinated, or Zelensky is not assassinated, or nobody gets rid of Putin. Assuming that we've got these same leaders, there has to be the balance of power is against the Ukrainians. But peace at any price, probably not. That's what they said in 1938-39. And I fear that there is a touch of what happened in 1938 and 39 now in Europe again. And that is why countries like the Baltic states, Poland and others, fear that Ukraine is just the beginning.
The beginning of what?
Russian expansionism, even more so. Putin, if you find the book I wrote on him, quote about him, quoted extensively from his own writing, where he said his actions are not because of NATO expansionism, although I do think that NATO was rather provocative at times, especially in Ukraine. But he has wanted to, the biggest mistake that Russia ever made was to allow for the collapse of the Soviet Union. And he wants to restore Russia's place in the world. It's a great state in Europe and the international community, because it went to being what was it called, upper Volta with rockets. It was completely humbled, and the West was quite humiliating to the Russians.
Paul, sorry to cut across you. I've got a couple of minutes left, but are you saying that essentially Trump and what Trump does, that he is standing between Europe and World War III? Is it Trump alone can stop that or dictate the outcome of whether that happens or not?
It could go either way, I think, is what you're implying. He's destroyed Article 5. That is the part of NATO which says one for all for one. It's quite clear that he won't guarantee anything at the moment. So that is the essence of how everybody's lived since 1948, 49, when it was first founded with 12 nations. He could start World War III, or perhaps he could help stop it. So it could be that he ends the Ukraine war with a lot of injustices to the Ukrainian people, at the same time inspiring extra expansionism by Russia into the Baltic states, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, and Poland, and so forth. And so if Britain can't find enough troops, 5 or 10,000, to monitor the ceasefire lines, how the hell is it going to defend the whole of Europe against Russia, which is marching into various states with some help, like the leadership in Hungary?
Professor Paul Moorcraft, really, really interesting. And thank you for joining us, Paul. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Good to chat to you.
Well, look, you're calling us this morning on the whole range of issues, from Putin and Trump to potholes to my sore hip. Lots and lots of you calling us this morning. So we'll get you on air after 10 today, 030-30-80-55-55. If you're sending me a tweet, at Stephen Nolan, and the 10 o'clock news is coming up right now. Good morning. I see David writing to us saying, please do a show on hip replacements. This is of interest to many of us who listen to you. We'll do that. We'll do some programming on hip replacements and knee replacements and how long you're having to wait and the cost of them if you go private and all that kind of stuff. So we'll do that in the days to come. Now, today marks 3 years since Russia launched its full-scale invasion of Ukraine. The conflict has since displaced millions of people, devastated cities, has cost thousands of lives. Many Ukrainians had to flee the country, and some of them have made Northern Ireland their home since. Anna originally from Ukraine, is now settled in Port Stewart. Hello, Anna.
Hello.
Good morning to you, Anna.
Good morning.
It must be very sad when you look at what's happening to your country.
Yes, it's so sad. It's like 2 years ago we wake up to explosion and realize that the world will never be the same, you know. This day changed our life.
Can you tell me about that day and what? Can you tell me about that day, Anna, and what you saw around you?
Sorry?
Can you tell me about that day and what you saw around you and how it felt to see your country being invaded?
About this day 3 years ago, yes.
Yes.
We wake up and I can't believe that the war started in the 2022. It was terrible. I can't explain what I feel in at that moment, but I can't explain, really. Maybe another Ukrainian people can understand me, but because it's not explained to the world. It's just your feeling, what you should do, what you must do now, how you can help, what you're feeling in the future.
What do you think, Anna, of President Zelensky?
It's a very hard question, really. We support our president, of course.
And do you think that your country should now do a deal that President Trump is trying to broker with the Russians?
You know, I am not political. Ukrainian stance, it's different of European values. And no international decision concerning Ukraine should be made without its direct involvement.
It must be very sad.
History has showed that the passion of no aggressor, an aggressor only... Ambulance future violators, and Ukraine needs steadfast allies who support and its sovereignty and security.
Finally, Anna, it must be very sad when you see the scenes in your country of how a lot of your country's been flattened. It's devastated.
Yeah.
Do you think, Anna, you will ever go home again?
Oh, you think it's for me, maybe like for every Ukrainian woman who has a child. I don't know what does wait in the future. Yes, of course, I want to come back at home because at home we have a very good life. I never want to change my country. I really like love my country. And but now I have a child, and for me it's important that in Northern Ireland it's a safety. And I want to say many thanks to people who opened his house and his heart and support us. It's very amazing people, really.
Anna, thank you for talking to me this morning. Thank you, Anna. The journalist John Sweeney is joining me from Kyiv. John, good morning to you.
Excuse me. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. Good morning. Well, what's the situation, John, in terms of how likely it will be that a deal that is agreeable to both Zelensky and Putin will be achieved?
Well, I don't think it's very likely at all, actually, to be honest with you, Stephen. What Trump has done is there is an international consensus. Russia invaded Ukraine. That was wrong. There are international sanctions placed on Russia, and the Western world has given a lot of military help to Ukraine to help them stay in the game, not enough to defeat Russia, but at least to stay alive. And now Trump has come in and upended that, and he sent his Secretary of State, Rubio, to Saudi Arabia to talk to the Russians. There were no Ukrainians there. Now, that's insulting. And Trump's rhetoric has just got worse and worse and worse. He said that Zelensky is a dictator. He's not a dictator. and he said that, you know, Ukraine should not have started this war. Well, that's disgusting, because Russia invaded Ukraine twice. And what's weird about this is that it's kind of galvanized Ukraine. And to be honest with you, in 23 and 24, being in Kyiv, going around, it was pretty depressing. The mood was sad. And in a funny way, it feels a bit like 2022 now, Kyiv, because people are going, what on earth is Trump doing? Oh, we've got to fight not just the Russians, but the Americans too. But okay, we'll fight them. Because the essential thing here is this, is that Trump thinks all Ukraine has to do is to trade land for peace, and that will satisfy Putin. The Ukrainians don't accept that. They fear that what Putin really wants isn't land, it's control. He wants to have his dark thumb all over Ukraine, for him to decide, for the Kremlin to decide who's in power here, and for Ukraine to be part, more or less, of Russia. And Ukrainians won't stand for that. So Donald Trump comes in with his ridiculous deal, way asking for tons and tons of billions, way more than the
$500 billion, it's been reported.
Yeah, well, I was at Zelensky's press conference yesterday, and the true number is $100 billion. But this, which is the Americans are given, and Zelensky said, thank you very much. We're very grateful for that. But this was money given to us. This was, you know, weapons and money to keep our economy going. But these were gifts or grants. They weren't loans. So for Trump to suddenly come in and say, oh, by the way, you know, I want my money back, that's not what the deal was. And the big geopolitical, obviously the Chinese Communist Party are watching, the big geopolitical thing is, do we really think it's a good idea to reward Vladimir Putin with invading his neighbor? Do we think that's good policy? Because if you do, then it creates chaos and more wars across the whole globe. It's the reason why both my grandfathers fought in the First World War and my father fought in the Second World War, is for the principle that a neighbor should not invade another country and try to steal their land. That's wrong. And Donald Trump doesn't get that.
Well, whether he gets it or not, he is the best chance of the war stopping short term, John, is he not?
No, because the Ukrainians don't want peace if peace has got Vladimir Putin's face plastered all over it. Because what he'll do is he'll hunt down all the Ukrainians who believe in a free and independent Ukrainian culture. Those people will be disappeared, they'll fall out of buildings, all of that. So this isn't a peace worth having, in their view. And by the way, watching Zelensky in the press conference yesterday, Stephen, it was grimly fascinating, because you could see the pressure he's under. And the journalists are asking, you know, well, what, you know, Trump's called you a dictator. And Zelensky said, hey, listen, if I was a dictator, I'd be annoyed. But I'm not a dictator. I'm a democratically elected politician. So he's got some humour still, but nevertheless, he's under immense pressure. And I know from my friends fighting on the front line in the Ukrainian army, it's really, really hard, because they've been fighting for 3 solid years. And they've lost so many of their friends. I went to a clinic where they put on, essentially they do tin legs, a 21st century version thereof, and they've got some sensors in the stumps which give people a bit of control of their prosthetics. There's one poor guy who's very funny and lovely, a guy called Anton, and he's lost one leg and 2 arms. And I asked him about Trump, and he said, listen, you know, I don't want to use bad language. I asked him about Putin, and he said, wait. And he put up 3 fingers in his black glove. So remember, his hands are now black and plastic. And he said, wait. And he slowly lowers 1 finger down and then the other finger. And he was left with one finger pointing directly at me to sort of say that was his response to Vladimir Putin.
John,
and that, by the way, is constant across everybody I've spoken to. They do not want the peace with Vladimir Putin's face on it.
But if a negotiation is not successful, John, is the Russian machine just too big to fail ultimately against Ukraine? And will it just lead to more and more deaths and the inevitable win by Russia? Is there any way Russia could lose this war, is what I'm asking.
Yes, it could if we applied sanctions effectively. And the danger is that Trump will sabotage that. Secondly, we in Europe and the Canadians, we need to rearm and really help the Ukrainians. Now, what's good is, essentially, that Scholz was doing a pretty good impression of Neville Chamberlain in Germany. He's gone, and the new guy, Merz, is good. So this is a moment. To be honest, I mean, listen, Stephen, I mean, I'm so old, I reported on the Romanian Revolution. And I was in Bucharest on Christmas Eve, 1989, and then Christmas Day, they've executed Ceausescu. And I thought, well, that's wonderful. That's the new world order. That's fantastic. And now Trump seems to be ripping all of that up. And the dictators seem to be on the march. But if the best of the rest of the West gives in and gives up on Ukraine, then war's not going to stop. It's just going to happen somewhere else. Taiwan, whatever North Korea wants to do next, all of that. We have to stand up to this evil. And the Ukrainians, I mean, there's a lot of Ukraine. They are determined, and they're going to keep on fighting. The idea that Trump can come in and solve this and say, oh, look, this is my perfect solution, that's not true. He said he could solve it in a day. That hasn't happened. He sent his one of his creatures, Rubio, to talk to the Russians, but there's no Ukrainians there. And yesterday, Zelensky said, listen, if this deal is not good for Ukraine, I will not sign it. And that is popular here.
Always good to talk to you, John. Hope to talk to you soon. Thank you very much indeed, sir. Thank you. 18 minutes past 10. The Pope has spent the 10th night in hospital as Catholics around the world continue to pray for his recovery. Colm Flynn is the Vatican Core for EWTN News. Colm, good morning.
Stephen, good morning from Rome.
So how is he?
Not looking good, to put it kind of in a line to you. The recent statement, the most recent one we got this morning from the Vatican press office around 7:30, 8 a.m., which said that he had slept well and rested. Now, we compare that to the last few days when normally it always is brief, their morning statement, but they might add to it that he had breakfast, he was up and about. This morning it said that he slept well and was rested. But the latest detailed statement we have to go on is from late last night when the Vatican said that he was in a critical condition, that although his severe asthma attack, he hadn't suffered another one, which he did on Saturday, they said that some blood tests had shown the onset of mild kidney failure, but they said that this was under control. Stephen, remember the last time we chatted, I reminded you that the Pope is knocking on the door of 90 at 88 years of age. He already had part of one of his lungs removed when he was a young man growing up in Buenos Aires in Argentina. Because he's been using a wheelchair over the past couple of years, he's put on an extra bit of weight. So when you add all of these health concerns into the mix, the situation right now, we believe here, is hanging in the balance. So the feeling around the Vatican at the moment, I'm looking out at the window at St. Peter's Basilica here in St. Peter's Square, the feeling is that they are praying, obviously, for the best, but, preparing and anticipating possibly the worst.
And, Colm, how does this work behind the scenes in any big institution when someone may or may not survive? There's often a lot of positioning that goes on. Will that have started already behind the scenes?
Yes, because of the Pope's age and he has suffered, underlying health conditions before, they would always have a plan in place as to when the inevitable will happen. But as far as the Vatican are concerned at the moment, we still have a sitting Pope, a successor of Peter, who is alive and being cared for by the best doctors in the Gemelli Hospital. And that's where the Popes have traditionally gone to get their treatment. They have a kind of a suite up on the 10th floor where the Pope is being cared for, kind of separated from other parts of the hospital. But, you know, they don't want to cause alarm, the Vatican, because as you can imagine, Stephen, if you've seen the movie Conclave, you have then cardinals coming from all over the world. You have the world's media descending on the city. And last night, I think I counted around 30 television crews already setting up in front of the Basilica. I could hear languages from all over the world. And then pilgrims. Pilgrims will start descending on the city if they think that the end is in sight. So they don't want to jump the gun. They're praying for a miracle. But of course, there's a plan in place, and it will lead to a funeral, state funeral, because it's Vatican City State. And then it will lead into the conclave and the election of a new pope.
Colm, thank you. Now, a police ombudsman report into the brutal murder of Marion Beattie over 50 years ago is due to be released soon. On March the 30th, 1973, 18-year-old Marion set out with her brother and best friend to a charity dance in Haddon's Garage on the outskirts of Auchnacloy in County Tyrone. She was leaving the hall with a young man around midnight, but she never returned. And her body was found hours later at the bottom of a quarry in just her underwear. Here's RUC Chief Superintendent Serift speaking to the BBC at the time.
This was a most vicious and cruel murder with sadistic overtones. A really terrible murder that shocked the whole community around here.
Even in Northern Ireland?
Even in Northern Ireland terms, this is the worst. I have some 28 years experience in the RUC. I've investigated quite a lot of murders, and this is certainly the worst in my book.
Many questions arose, most importantly, who killed her? And how did nobody else see what happened? In 2019, Vinnie and I made a podcast series, Getting Away With Murder, where we looked in depth at the Marion Beattie case. In the podcast, Marion's friend, Nuala, revealed that when she was questioned by the police the following day, one of the officers interviewing her had been at the dance.
And then they interviewed me. And one of the men sitting in the interview was the man that asked me to dance the night before. So I thought, well, he's bound to know who they were, you know. He was policeman here, and I mean, the place, Auchnacloy, isn't that big of a place. He's bound to have known who they were. But he didn't.
Decades later, the murder remains unsolved and the case open. You can search for the podcast Nolan True Crime on BBC Sounds, the podcast on Marion Beattie that Vinnie and I made all those years ago. The police ombudsman is due to report on the case in the coming weeks. Jared Beattie, younger brother of Marion, is with me this morning. Good morning, Jared.
Good morning, Noel.
Good morning. Well, look, where's your head at with this, Jared?
Well, just with the ombudsman, we have to meet them on the 20th of March. So we have it's the two detectives from England. There were two ICC detectives. I took on Marion. Well, they were given Marion's case, and we were speaking to them last year. And now they've given us an update that they're going to produce whatever they have found on the 20th of March.
Do you hold out any hope that you'll get more answers?
Yeah, hope so. You know what I mean? We're not going to stop anyway. It doesn't matter, you know. So we're going to push the whole way.
And in terms of working out what happened to Marion, what's your gut instinct?
Well, there's somebody in round Auchnacloy area had done it, because we were speaking to people that did work in the quarry, and they said there was no way a stranger went down into that quarry in the dark, because they'd have been lying down beside your sister. They had to know their knowledge of their way down into the quarry. So they did.
What has this done to your family over the years, Jared, not knowing?
It's just tears apart. to it has. You know?
It's what?
It's just tearing us apart.
I can understand that.
It's just tearing us apart.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I can understand that.
Yeah.
And for you, you were her younger brother.
Yeah, I was only 13 whenever it happened.
Can you remember it happening?
Yeah, I can remember every bit of it because my older sister, Una, she came out and we were playing football outside and she said, my daddy wants you to. And we went in and my daddy was sitting just at the window and he just turned around and he says, the man behind you is looking at you. And I turned around and all I could just see was a white collar. And I went, oh my God, mummy's dead in Lurgan, because mummy had gone over to Lurgan to arrange during his wedding. And then he just turned around and says, boys, a bad news for you. That your sister was found in the bottom of the quarry this morning.
And as a young 13-year-old, you're trying to compute, aren't you?
Yeah. And then when mum came home, I can, even sitting here, I can still hear her squealing whenever she came home, whenever they told her. Whenever she came into the house and they had to get the doctor to inject her to calm her down.
My goodness.
Yeah.
I can see back in 2019, the police ombudsman saying that in 2017, after concerns had been raised by the family, the PSNI referred the circumstances surrounding Marion's murder to the police ombudsman. They said, we have since commenced an inquiry which focuses on the family's concerns that paramilitaries, police officers or police informants may have been involved in the murder and that not all evidential opportunities were pursued. Tell me why the family thinks paramilitaries, police officers or police informants may have been involved.
Well, with the information we have got so it is, you know. They told around her that there was 5 suspects that they had get up with the ombudsman here, had told us in the hotel in Belfast. People has told us that the fella had done it, his father was involved in the paramilitary and stuff.
And have you had many leads recently, or has it all gone quiet, Jared?
We've had a few leads. We've got, because we put it on the thing there, whenever the TNG put the thing on there, I was speaking to the cousin last night, and she's got a phone call, and we have to go and meet this person. So we'll not know until we see this person to see what's what.
And you say the family's not going to stop until you get answers, but if there hasn't been... If there haven't been answers up to now, Jared, it just might be unlikely that you get a full picture of what happened.
Oh, we will get a full picture, honestly, because we are not giving up. No chance. It's coming 52 years and they ain't stopping now. I don't care. You know, so I hope he's listening because we're coming for you, to be honest with you.
And what does that mean, not stopping? What are you going to do?
Well, I'm not going to. I'm just going to keep fighting and fighting until we get the truth. Because at the very start, the PS or the RUC used to come here, 2 detectives, and told my mummy they would have him arrested within 2 weeks. 52 years on, still no arrest.
Well, look, the police ombudsman is due to report in just a couple of weeks' time now, Jared.
Let's see.
And we'll stay in touch, hopefully, with each other and the programme. In the meantime, Jared, thank you, sir.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye.
Podcast is still available on BBC Sounds. If you search Nolan True Crime, you'll find the podcast on Marion Beattie there now if you want to get across the story. That's it for today. We'll see you tomorrow when we start at 9 o'clock. Have a good Monday, and thanks for listening.
The biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet at Stephen Nolan. Steven!
Nolan Show!